Great, thank you. We have the word from our engineers that we have gone live. We expect to have a very robust internet audience today. But I must say I am very grateful and quite impressed at the showing, given the snows of Cornell that are falling out there today and expect to keep falling. So thank you so much for making the effort to come out and be here in person to meet our guest, Harry Lewis, who is the Gordon McKay Professor at Harvard College, was Dean of Harvard College, Professor of Computer Science. And all of those accolades are critical and important. This afternoon he will be speaking over in B17 at 4:15, more to issues of privacy and technology, and I'm very grateful to see many people, including the chairman of Computer Science, with us today. This morning, we are going to have a conversation about undergraduate education in the broadest sense, reflecting the work of Professor Lewis in his book, Excellence Without a Soul. And before I say anything more about it, I will introduce him and let him say all of those things. I do want to invite our internet audience to please send in questions as you can on the interface that we are using for our streaming today. And Matt Klein from Cornell Information Technologies will be feeding those questions to Professor Lewis, and certainly people here who have made the effort through our snows to attend. I welcome you warmly to have this be a conversation, and that's why we're sitting here somewhat informally before you rather than podium and PowerPoint and so forth. We would love to really talk and engage on this question of the meaning of our undergraduate education. Professor Lewis, welcome.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for being here. I mean, if this was a Harvard audience, I would thank them for making it here at 9:30 in the morning, as opposed to through the snow. It's okay. Like nobody shows up at anything, faculty, students, anything, at 9:30 in the morning. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for making the effort also. Why don't we just begin with a general question. What do you mean by excellence of the soul or without a soul?
Without a soul. So yeah. So this was a risky title for various reasons. While I was writing it, that the book of which this is the title is really a series of issues about various things that I confronted during the 8 years I spent as dean of the college at Harvard. So I was computer science professor for most of my career, and during eight of them I moved into the administration building and took responsibility for some aspects of undergraduate education, not the curriculum actually, but the student life and student affairs and residential life and all that, and obviously in the mix on cooperation, cooperating with people on the curricular issues. So. I came out of it with a series of particular issues that I talk about in the book. I talk about grading, I talk about intercollegiate athletics and various other things. But the big thing that I wanted to say, which is really what got me to the title, was that we seem to be an institution that was optimized. University is a system, and the system had evolved in such a way, not entirely by design, although you could find some design decisions along the way that got us there, to really produce extraordinary excellence. And I don't mean that Harvard is any different from any of the other top universities in this regard, because we are all competing with each other on the same standards of excellence, actually, nationally. We were doing an extraordinarily good job as research institutions, and that trickled down into our graduate and undergraduate programs, and we're graduating undergraduate students, which was really my main focus of attention, more than the graduate programs. We were graduating undergraduate students who were came in extremely gifted and ambitious and went out extremely expert and continuing to win prizes and got socialized nicely in various ways and were actually generally pretty happy with their undergraduate experience, but to some degree all seem to be operating in parallel universes without anything in common that with which they could define what the significance of their education was. There was no kind of no sense that the university had set a direction for them that was of any significance to how they were going to lead their lives later on, except for by giving them the skills and the expertise. So these were people who had, you know, we were graduating people who had a great deal of excellence, but there was no common soul. So this is, I sort of ascribe to university the possibility of of having a soul. And I contrasted it with some acknowledged nostalgia for a particular moment in Harvard history where I actually thought, you know, the faculty kind of got it together across disciplines and had a vision of something that was important to civilization and to the future that they all kind of agreed on, at least for a few decades. So that there's a lot in my thinking and in my book about, you know, what goes around comes around, and universities have been, you know, the same old problems keep coming up over and over again, and people keep tripping over them as though they'd never seen them before. I was telling Tracy this morning, I found a wonderful reference from one of Harvard's presidents in the turn of the 20th century, being subject to orders from the governance board to increase educational efficiency and to have the faculty start doing the work that the assistants were used to doing, and so on. So I said, well, it's only a century for that wheel to keep to turn around again. But anyway, the moment that I was thinking of where I actually thought my institution, you know, had a soul was a moment when it became engaged with the responsibility of universities to educate people who would not allow civilization to perish, which after the Second World War, I think my university and a number of others I know actually thought that the near catastrophe that had happened, you know, they might have some control over whether such a thing could ever happen again. And, you know, I kind of felt this, you know, when I went into the voting booth in Massachusetts to vote for governor a couple of years ago, you know, I looked on the ballot and I had this sudden recognition. There was a Green Party candidate and a Libertarian candidate and a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate, you know, and three out of the four had actually been through Harvard College during the years I'd been teaching there. And I said, you know, if I don't like the choices here, or if the electorate votes in somebody, you know, who really do we have to blame for the fact that, our political leaders are clueless about the way a representative democracy should work? So I think so we actually, you know, at that time, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s, and then it persisted, you know, into the 70s. You know, had a kind of common curriculum, not a set of required courses, but a curriculum of which there was a thread that said, you know, we live in a free society, we can't take it for granted, people have to understand where the tensions and values are in being privileged to be in a democracy like that. And, and this is important, and whether you're going to be a math professor or you're going to be an electrical engineer, whether you're going to be a poet or whatever it is, you know, there ought to be some part of your undergraduate education where you spend, you know, recognizing that and talking about it. And that's gone, and it's gone, and, you know, we've had a couple of new general education programs and others, but, you know, it's gone not only from the curriculum, but it's gone from the discourse. I it's not the only possible soul that you could have, you know, that around which some sense of overall educational direction to an undergraduate education could be centered. It happens to be one I think is particularly particularly important as I witness the dysfunction of the American democracy, which I think we're probably pretty broad consensus isn't working very well, and we all complain about our political leaders, and they all come from places like the Ivy League schools and so on, right? So who do we have to blame if we think the American democracy isn't working? So I particularly am attracted to this one, but it's not the only possible soul of an undergraduate education. And we've lost it. I'll just say a few words more, and then I'll let you ask another question or something. Yeah, we've lost it for a number of reasons, but the usual right-wing cranks, will say it's because we're all communists, or it's because we're all selfish and self-centered and narcissistic in our the way or you'll get the usual anti-intellectual stuff that gets thrown where people in universities are subject to jealousy and bitterness and so on. So it's just one more grievance that you have against universities. And I fundamentally have no grievances against universities. They're my entire life. They're my wife's life. They're my I think they're tremendously important to the future of America and the world. And they're doing a wonderful job at a particular thing. But my sense is that we have so optimized the system by which faculty are trained and hired, and the measures of expertise by which departments rise and fall, and so on, towards objectives of scholarly excellence and research productivity, and which again I want to stress could not be more important to the future of the country and the world. We are the engines of prosperity, ultimately. But the system has been so optimized along those dimensions that it's very hard to get even a conversation going hard to get leadership to stand up and say in any way that anyone will take seriously, in any way that has a that provides an incentive or a reward for the faculty to think about these larger issues about the future of society as part of the responsibility to undergraduate education. I think we've lost our capacity to orate, talk, discuss, and come to consensus around these things because it's just been squeezed out in this process of optimizing the system for other dimensions.
Hmm. Yes, sir.
One of the issues that we are
you're a veteran of that curriculum that I discussed, right?
Yes, I am.
Former dean of faculty, Charlie Wolcott. I think this will work if I carry it. Is that correct? Show me a sign in the booth there.
Okay.
Well, here, I'll let you hold it.
I'll hang on to it. My question is, we are going through a Middle States accreditation review at the moment, that is preparing all the paperwork, and one of the major issues that we've been asked to contemplate is that of assessment.
Yes.
How do we assess fundamentally the value that the university has provided to students? What's your view of that, and how do you measure what is really important as opposed to the easy things to measure? It's easy to measure whether they can spell and write a simple sentence. It's easy to measure whether they know the kings of England, as it were. But what's hard, it seems to me, is all the things that are important.
Yes.
That you were just discussing.
Yes, it's very hard, and I'm afraid if we tried to assess them, we wouldn't like what we would learn. So let me begin with my lighthearted answer, which I was going to get before you got grave there, is that we know that our students are learning more and more every year because more and more of them get A's every year than the year before. So.
Yes, well, that's another issue.
What finer form of assessment do you need than that? There are these tests of civic literacy, that try to figure out whether people know which is the First and which is the Fourth Amendment, or not what their numbers are, but any concept of what they say. And places like yours and ours, I'm assuming yours, I know about ours, don't do very well. There are these metrics where you can actually establish that students know that 4 years of university education at an Ivy League school actually has a negative impact on people's understanding of these things. They either forget what they learned or they unlearn them. My scariest, that's a survey by some group which I can't remember and which may have a political agenda. That's why you always have to be careful with these metrics. It looked reasonably fair to me, but since I can't remember the name or the statistics, I won't say it anymore. One of the scarier, and this is actual scholarship, reports that I learned was that undergraduates in universities, this is not a Harvard study, this is some broader group, become less moral and less ethical from before till after they've taken the undergraduate economics course. Okay, so EC1 or whatever you call it here, presumably because it makes people more dispassionate about certain kinds of what they had previously considered to be, moral judgments. Their scores on certain ethical scales, decline. I worry. I guess my answer to the question is, now that I've blathered a little bit, trying to process the question. You've been asked to assess how you're doing at the things that you say you're doing, right?
Well, one of the things you have to determine first is, of course, what do you think you're doing?
Exactly. So as long as you don't say you're doing any of this kind of, civic education, responsibility for, being leaders in society and so on, and instead are simply, training people to be, engineers and economists, the assessment problem goes away by virtue of the fact that you haven't set those as objectives. If you set them as objectives, have you set them as objectives? Are they anywhere below the level of the mission statement? We have some of that in kind of our mission statement, but
we're working on this, and there are certain objectives that you can, I think, probably generally agreeable, but to me they are relatively low level objectives. That's why it seems to me your comment about the soul, is so much more important, and that's the toughest possible thing to measure, it seems to me.
This is a flippant answer, but it's meant in a serious vein. Any test you can design, students will figure out how to game, because we all have really smart students, and the way they got into our kinds of institution is to some degree by learning how to game tests of various things, right? So it's very hard to, it still might be a thing worth doing, but requirements and tests and so on, that part of the system has also been optimized to achieve that end. you know, the way you really figure out whether you've been successful is by talking to people on their 50th reunions or their 25th reunions. Now that's kind of a rather slow feedback loop into your educational process. You will have undergone 7 curricular reviews between the time you taught them and the time you're able to determine whether it was successful. But I actually do think alumni feedback, maybe even on a 5 or 10 year time frame, has given people enough distance from the courses they hated the most to be able to acknowledge that those courses may have done them some good. You know, one of my complaints about the way of the world is that we rely so much on immediate student feedback. You know, I love students. I'm interested in hearing what they have to say. You know, but I thought as a mechanism for designing, you know, our structures, it was a very poor measure. You know, I think that student evaluations of faculty, at least the way we do them, are it doesn't matter how well you write the questions. The answers are always correlated with whether you like the professor or not, and very often whether you like the professor turns out, when you do psychometric studies of student course evaluations, to be largely associated with measures of cheerfulness and optimism, have nothing to do with the course itself. Do you do student course evaluations here? Do you know about the Abadi Rosenthal study? Okay, so that I can tell you a little more about it if you're curious. But we got another question here.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to your opening comments and challenge them a little bit, because while I agree that universities 100, 200 years ago were established for these general maintenance of social values and continuation of liberty and freedom and all these other things, with the foundation of the land-grant system and the foundation of Cornell, which has been described as a new American university, that
right.
changed a lot.
Right.
And certainly with the development of science and technology and engineering and the sort of the real prominence this is playing in our futures, the university has taken on new roles, clearly. And parts of the university are now very well connected with these new social roles, so that there's, if you translate soul into purpose, the university, the universities now have a dual purpose, in a sense, to continue these ancient traditions that you describe, but also these new needs of society, which are increasingly being called upon to save American civilization
right.
in terms of the future. And so I think our challenges are different than you describe them. They're both covering the liberal arts and ethics and values, but also applying these in terms of the new technologies that we're asked to be developing for the future of society.
I don't disagree with that. It's just I just see the first one getting lost. You think it's there you think it's in reasonable equipoise in between these two kinds of objectives?
I don't think all parts of, if you're trying to sort of save the humanities, for example, as there are discussions about this, it's not going to save all of humanities. But any decision we're making about our future in terms of sustaining ourselves has a value base to it.
Yes.
So you have to confront that in any sort of reasonable discourse. It's not just technology. It's how that's being applied, the inequalities that exist in who gains access to this, so that there are a whole range of social values that are built into these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, I actually think the engineering schools are in some ways actually in better shape on these issues than many of what used to be the humanistic disciplines are. I mean, I think it's a somewhat weird development, because you know, you used to think of learning the classics as, you know, the place where you would learn, you know, where people might get some sense of virtue, right?
Right.
But
right.
Actually, it's in engineering. It's more. I think it's more likely to come up in engineering, where you know you doing this really interesting research on tissue engineering or something like that, and you can actually you know go over to the hospital and imagine, right. you know, the difference it can make if you you know if you can you can achieve it. So, so I think part of this is definitely disciplinary based. I'm actually going to save a little of my fire on this for my talk this afternoon because I'm going to talk about it there in that context. But another piece of the puzzle, I think, you know, let me just throw out another potentially controversial proposition on this. I don't know what the mix is in this audience. I see a couple of engineers, and maybe biased that way. But one of my theses is that what happened after the Second World War, when, as you quite correctly reported, you're right. It goes back to the founding of Cornell and the Morrill Act and all the rest of that. And my place has a particular troubled, ambiguous history about doing these stuff where you got your hands dirty. You know? So that's we have particular issues at Harvard that with you know that I've had to live with my whole life. But the what happened after the Second World War, when the real money started to come into science and engineering, and there was an enlightened recognition economic future of America was going to be driven, as well as national security, going to be driven by scientific progress. It got coupled later in, starting I think in the 60s, with the social changes that were happening in America and universities' recognition of the social biases in their faculty hiring and student admissions processes was that the, and it actually goes a little bit to Charlie's question, was that universities started to develop objective measures of quality for their faculty. Right, we, which was easy to do in the sciences. So we started, ranking people according to their scholarly output, and trying to shift the kind of old boy hire your graduate student for your when you retire kind of way of appointing faculty, which tended to produce pretty severe social biases. To some more objective way where that would both improve quality and allow previously discriminated groups to get a greater foothold in the academy. And, one of my theses is that system, which worked perfectly in science and engineering, worked far less perfectly in the humanities, where the standards of quality are less objective, the most important thing may not be the thing that changes everybody's mind from one day to the next, and where it has an inherently more conservative structure, not politically conservative, but in terms of preservation of tradition is more what they have historically done. So the humanists now get judged according to these, quality metrics, rather than on, what will the students remember in the value sphere, 10 or 20 or 30 years of what they actually got out of reading, Shakespeare or the classics or, you know, or whatever it is. And so the humanities faculty are kind of caught in an unhappy bind, because they probably went into these fields because they're we're studying something essential about what it means to be human. That's why they're called the humanities, after all. They're not called, you know, literary critics or whatever it is. But actually, they're not being judged in the promotion and tenure process on their humanistic values. They're being judged on their whether they can produce books the way the scientists produce research papers. Anyway, so.
Hi. I liked your. I thought your answer was right on in terms of assessment, in that you know you. It starts with what you say you're going to do.
Could you mind actually introducing yourself? I'm curious where my questions are coming from.
Matthew Hare. I'm in the Department of Natural Resources. And yet I'm having a little hard time engaging with this because it seems like there's several definitions of soul that are being used, and you've related it to civic mindedness,
right.
Civic engagement, which is maybe a narrow piece of it.
Yeah.
But then we're also sort of talking about liberal arts education.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered if you could juxtapose your broader ideas of soul against the philosophy of liberal arts education. Because it occurs to me, has anybody ever assessed the liberal arts education and whether that's delivered what it's ideally meant to deliver?
So it's another assessment. You're asking me another assessment question about about liberal arts education. I don't have a different answer than I gave to Charlie. I think it's something that's hard to measure in the short run. About the whether I'm changing definitions or not. My point was I've got one notion of soul which is pretty clear in my mind. That curriculum that endured at Harvard for 30 years or so and was inspired by a particular historical event and which I believe actually produced a consensus in the faculty. Can you imagine getting a consensus in the faculty about anything like that today? It's very hard to imagine. In anything except a religious institution, by the way, I should just say, that's another definition of soul. I think the Catholic colleges are having their own troubles as the figuring out what they're about in secular societies. But I think if we had a representative from a religious institution here, they would probably offer their own notion of what the soul of their education was supposed to be or had been or something. It's not mine. I'm not a religious person, and the soul in my title is in no way, intended to suggest that. But those are a couple of examples, and I'm not suggesting that that every institution has to find that ideal, that motivating ideal, in the same place. But there's a I'd say there's at least two pretty clear examples. Now, critics, including the people who classify themselves as critical scholars, skeptics about all of these kind of idealistic visions of what social institutions have defined themselves to be, will dismiss my idealism as, a nostalgic view of something that never was. And in fact, one of we had a few of us had dinner last night, but I acknowledge that, unhappy as it makes me, I have to respect the principal author of Harvard's most recent general education report. Luke Benand, an English professor at Harvard, wonderful wonderful writer and thinker who describes what I remember as this commitment to democratic ideals as a motivating force in undergraduate education as an attempt to create a benign national ideology. So yeah, that's another take on far less. But let me get back to your question. So you wanted me to say something about liberal education or liberal arts education. It's not distant from what classical liberal education is supposed to do. A classical liberal education, in my view, is actually supposed to be liberating. I think it's not actually a coincidence that that's the root term in there, and that what it's supposed to do. And it's designed around, I believe, the fact that it's being presented to people at a particular developmental stage, their late adolescence, on their way to adulthood, more at the end than they were at the beginning of their college career. And they're, in places like ours anyway, largely away from their families for the first time. Not so much since the invention of the cell phone, but nonetheless. We have an opportunity to expose them to and make them think about the way people in the past have thought about what it meant to be human and a member of a human society. So that's my kind of interpretation of what a liberal education means today. There's the trivium and the quadrivium and, do all that. But it's actually less about, it degenerates to some degree, gets redefined, implemented, certainly has it my place. I don't know, what a liberal arts college, outside a university context would say about this. But, in my place, what we tend to define a liberal arts education as meaning as is an education where students get exposed to the various academic disciplines of the scholarly experts that are distributed around the faculty. And with that kind of objective, then it quickly degenerates into a turf game. Everybody, the sciences get a third, and the social sciences get a third, and the humanities get a third. Except we're now in eighth, so who gets the extra? Who gets the extra 1/8 or 2/8 or so on and so forth. So it very quickly degenerates from trying to think about these larger ideals of what you're trying to accomplish into just making sure that everybody gets represented who's in a specialty. But I think fundamentally the real objective is very much in line with what we used to think liberal arts education meant.
Cornelia Farnham from the College of Veterinary Medicine. I wonder if you could comment a bit on how much what students' expectations are when they enter drives what we do.
Yeah.
And I too am a product of a liberal arts education at a red and white institution, but on the West Coast at about the same time as you were. And I would think it would be fair to say that I entered there because my parents believed in a liberal education. I became a veterinarian. Thinking of my professional goals as quite separate from, not separate, but at a different time point. And I think that students nowadays aren't looking to that kind of adding on to a liberal education, that they may be entering with much more professional goals in mind. And I, what I'm also interested in your comments of, is that appropriate and realistic for today's young students, both in terms of the economics of the education as well as their whole approach to what their careers are going to be?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question because it hits on a point that I wanted actually to talk about. One of my complaints, I have lots of complaints, but one of my complaints is that this tension gets defined as a tension between liberal and professional studies. And in my institute, I don't know enough about Cornell, but at Harvard, there's only one professional undergraduate degree program, and it's in engineering. And we don't have a separate admissions process. We have a we choose our engineering students come from the same admissions pool as everybody else. And there is a tension in the air in my place about pre-professionalism. That you know, students who have pre-medical expectations are going to be the death of us, and so on. And the us meaning often people who are over on the more humanistic side of the, you know, of the discipline. And you know, we certainly believe that you can major in anything and go on and make a career later on, but. And there's plenty of evidence for that, and that you know, law schools always choose people who study the classics, and all and all the rest of that. What's changed, and which I don't think we did enough to self-assess over the last several decades, when we have been going on through various somewhat wrenching changes in our undergraduate affairs. What's changed is that our student body has changed drastically, and changed drastically in two related ways. One is, as you say, you know, everybody has become more economically motivated, particularly the most ambitious people, and we tend to get increasingly ambitious students, we all do. But the other is that it's perfectly reasonable that our student body is more economically motivated than they used to be, because on average they have less money than they used to, right? It's I've been so frustrated in some of my conversations with my colleagues who complain about and rue and Harvard's getting all of these people and all they want to do is make money, and it's not like it was 30 years ago when we were all, we just wanted to write poetry. And I said, like if you already have money, writing poetry is kind of a reasonable objective. If you don't have money, you probably want to make some before you start thinking about writing poetry. So, but that increases the burden on us. It does two things. First of all, we've got to get past this notion that somehow professional and liberal education are in some opposition, and that as I say, that the examples that I talked about engineering, certainly the human values are actually run through the engineering, or certain parts of the engineering curriculum, and some in some fields more in greater evidence than they do in some of what we label the humanistic disciplines, but. So we have to get past that. But those who teach political science and philosophy and all the rest of it have got to recognize that as we've all done more outreach to students who come from more disadvantaged backgrounds socioeconomically and parts of the country that we never used to get students from. That we're getting students who are not as well educated in high school as the students of the past were, right? Which is a good thing. It's a fine thing that we now take the valedictorian from, you know, a school that we never would have taken anybody from 20 years ago. But guess what? You know, we can't expect that person to understand the you know, how humanistic thinkers or political thinkers or the legal scholars and so on, have thought about these things, because that wasn't part of their high school experience. So I think it actually increased. I think the forces that you've described quite accurately, you know, the rising expectations of families for that their children become employable and all the rest of that. I don't see anything wrong, you know, with any of that. I mean, I'm a member of an engineering school. Nothing wrong with it. But it's not incompatible with having a kind of institutional philosophy that supports some kind of curriculum or program or thread running through the college to tell people there are these other important things that, you know, that you should learn as part of that education as well. But you're absolutely right about what's where those forces are.
Since I have the mic.
Yeah, hi.
I'm Kathleen Gemmel from Arts and Sciences here at Cornell, and I would just note that it is our engineering college that requires the greatest chunk of arts and sciences coursework for their students, so I think they share an appreciation.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. What I would take issue with, I think, is the notion that the liberal arts are so targeted, that the goal and the mission of the liberal arts would be so targeted as to create a civilized populace. A central objective of the college is to expose students to the very different ways that one can define truth or develop factual information. You do this differently in the sciences than you do in the social sciences, and there are quite different ways of coming to an understanding of how things are in through studying the humanities. So what we might want to assess is, have we adequately exposed students to those very different ways of understanding the world and our place in it? I don't know exactly where else I'm going to go with that, but
well, that's I actually so that's a good question. No, what? Yeah, it was a good question. We're agreed on that, right? Okay. So now I'm going to say something disagreeable. Okay. you have just precisely described what happened in the transition from that old red book curriculum to what Harvard called the core curriculum, which wasn't a core curriculum, it was the curriculum that we adopted in the late 70s, which defined itself exactly as you have described, that the purpose of the general education program in my institution was to expose students to different ways of knowing, different ways of apprehending knowledge, different modes of inquiry, in a kind of neutral way, that, you know, we're all good whether we're mathematicians or sociologists or so on, and everybody ought to see how we think of that. And I, with all due respect, refers to that as the narcissistic motivation for a educational requirement, which is the one where the faculty all congratulate themselves on how important their disciplines are, which are all equally important for students to apprehend. And when they are going to see how what the different approaches to knowledge are, they just happen to be the different approaches to knowledge of the various people who happen to be teaching in that institution at that moment of time. Now, what happened, the effect of that way of viewing things was that we thought it was equally good for students to take courses in areas where the, well, there's two things that happened. One was one on the subject matter oddity and one on the sort of methodological, or which is kind of a way of describing what this approach is to knowledge, ways of apprehending things took us. So let me say what happened to us on the approaches to knowledge side was that we had weird periods in minor cultures of odd moments in time as reasonable things for people to take in order to become exposed, because they got to see the historian of that weird culture at that weird moment in time in action, and therefore presumably got to apprehend it. But they couldn't learn anything about constitutional law, because that was taught by the law faculty, which was a professional thing and was not part of the liberal arts education. When we managed to somehow sneak in, you know, somebody on the side, you know, would teach a course on the development of the Constitution or something, you get like 1,000 students taking it, right? So we got very weird subject matter disparities as a result of that. But that's okay, because, you know, the philosophy was not to teach people subject matter. It was to teach people ways of apprehending knowledge and how, you know, the different academic disciplines do that. And the trouble there was we never assessed, and I have a great deal of skepticism, having known a lot of Harvard students who were exposed, I think that's the term you use, to these various disciplinary approaches by that structure. We never made any attempt to assess whether anybody thought any differently about anything after taking a course in, you know, dinosaur cladograms than they were before they took the course on dinosaur cladograms, where they got to see the paleontologist in action, you know, talking about how you classify dinosaurs. Okay, so, you know, I think in practice what that happened to, as attractive as the notion of exposure to approaches to knowledge might be, was that a lot of students took a lot of courses from which they didn't learn very much that stuck with them for very long. That was our experience. Now maybe you've been able to do it better than we did, which certainly we couldn't have done it much worse in some ways. So I would certainly respect that as a possibility. But we never even tried to make the assessment as to whether we'd actually opened anybody's mind to a different way of viewing the world by making the mathematician take the humanities course and the humanist take the math course.
Except that presumably to succeed in those courses, the students have to have demonstrated an ability to think in the way that someone in that discipline approaches acquiring knowledge, approaches testing, and
well, they had to succeed in satisfying the professor in that course, that they had been able to answer the questions the way the professor in that course wanted them answered, and that professor was a professor in that discipline. So in that narrow sense, your answer is tautologically correct. But well, whether anything stuck to their ribs of larger significance, you know, a few years later, I think is I'm somewhat skeptical.
One has to hope they weren't just being asked to regurgitate facts and in any of those Harvard courses.
I had a couple of my children went through some of these courses. So.
Very quickly, as I'm carrying the microphone, Harry, is it the failure to make connections between the disciplines to understand something?
I actually think this is a way with my my slap at Luc Menand's dismissal of the Red Book, the General Education in a Free Society. This is one thing he actually got right in his redefinition of what the educational program should be, which is that the new one explicitly talks about not the what I describe as the narcissistic. It's about me. It's about the way I, the sociology professor, understand the world that you are here to learn. But it's specifically instead about the connection to your later life, right? The, our the new program is supposed to teach people who are not going to be disciplinary specialists in our various disciplines why the hell they should care about what they learn and what parts of their non-Harvard life, their postgraduate life, their life. They don't use the word citizens, but I'm going to use the word, you know, citizens. The various subjects have significance. So I think that's a constructive improvement.
Marcia Eames-Sheevely in the Department of Horticulture.
Uh-huh.
In our program, we have been really inspired by the work of Rachel Kessler, who has studied the soul of adolescence, the spiritual development of adolescence, and actually offers a framework that we are enamored with that looks at how to foster soul in young people. And, you know, in the beginning, you were laying out the problem, that is, that young people are extremely expert but with no common soul. And you talked about scholarly excellence and research productivity, but at a cost. So sort of turning that around and looking at what is soul fostering, I'm just curious as to what are the systems or the approaches or the frameworks that you've come across that have been really inspiring to you, that you've been really impressed with?
I should read her work. I'm prepared to learn something. I don't have a lot of good models to go on, and I hope everybody's figured out by now I'm a complete amateur in this field. I wasn't trained to think or talk about any of this stuff. I've done a certain amount of reading and reasoning about it, and worrying. I think another thread, another reason why it matters, just let me say this, is that I worry, and again, I don't have a lot of expertise. I'm not a historian of higher education. I'm not even a broadly knowledgeable scholar of higher education as it exists today. So I always run the risk when I give these talks of being excessively focused on the failures of my own institution, about which I know too much, and appreciate too little the successes of other institutions about which I know too little. So I want to be clear about that. But you know, there are phenomena in American society that we all recognize that Harvard can't be solely responsible for. So I think there's got to be some blame that gets shifted, has to be shared to a larger degree, and one is just the anti-intellectualism and ignorance of the American population in general. The fact that there are more people who believe in astrology than in evolution. The general contempt that political figures have for any kind of intellectual argument or even the possibility of any kind of intellectual idealism and so on. And I worry whether the experience of students, maybe not in your program, which is great that you've taken so seriously, the writings of people that I don't even know.
Oh, and I really want to clarify, we're inspired by this, we're striving for it. We haven't got the answers.
Without that, you can't do anything. So it's good to get good inspired. That the people we're graduating may have their own anti-intellectual streak because of the weirdness of the way they perceive what we think is important in the world. They walk out and say, string theory. She's really into string theory. That's cool, but I'm out of here now. You'd like them to come away with some greater respect for why we think what we do is important than I think they sometimes get. That was not a reference to Lisa. Lisa Randall is terrific. I shouldn't have suggested by saying string theory.
Thank you, Marcia, for introducing another thinker that we will all look into. And as I'm carrying the microphone now, I'll ask the question, do you think that some of these problems are certainly not a failure of our moral fiber in the society or even in higher education, but maybe something to do with the historical moment that you said framed the original good picture of a generation ago?
Yeah,
and then I'm going to add one other thought and hand the phone to you, and that is whether the 19th century disciplinary model has so imposed itself on undergraduate education as to kind of create this disciplinary hermetic vacuum. Here you go.
Thank you. You want me to answer those questions, or is it just like you don't want me to answer them? All right. Hi.
Hi. I was an undergraduate. Now I'm a master's student. Now in computer science as well. But my question is maybe, is it possible to teach any of these things when I think what matters is what are the consequences for students' actions? And I, from my high school, I know that the valedictorian or the top students in the class are very often the ones who cheated, and they ended up at these institutions. And the ones who graduate at the top of the class very often are the ones who, again, cheat in class. So, and they're the ones who, when these objective measures will end up at these, you know, the CEOs of the next company. You look at this Enron, you look at, they completely falsify their resume. So I think it's a matter of, maybe we should think about more incentives or consequences for actions. You can teach, like in a humanities class, what's the right thing to do, but at the end of the day, I think students know very well what they have to write for the term paper to get an A, but that has they know very well who's going to get a job when they graduate, and that's just a matter of, and I think these are what drives the long term. And whereas in making a small society, people are going to, you know, you cheat or something, you might be ostracized. Whereas I know students, if they get caught, it's okay, we'll put a black mark on your file, no, your employers will not see it, nobody's going to know,
right. You
get a stamp.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, that's a, there's a solution to the problem, right,
You graduate from the most prestigious institution, and nobody even knows about it. And then when the students who do, who might follow the rules, they know very well they're not going to come out ahead.
Let me begin with something that may not be reassuring to you, given that you seem to be on your way to the top pretty well yourself. You're a graduate student in computer science at Cornell, but
I'm doing pretty well. But
okay, so the good news is that there was actually a study. Somebody should do this study over again. This is kind of a 25-year-old study or something like that of who was successful coming out of Harvard. And now you have to define success, of course. So, but it was a ed school thesis, and so they, I think the success was defined on the basis of, self-reported satisfaction with one's own success. There was family income was a piece of it, but only a third, and the third was community involvement and community leadership, or some combination of things like that that did not overweight, the narrow professional success. And the result was that among people who graduated from Harvard, and again, I'll bet you'd get the same result here. There's nothing distinctive about Harvard, but there is something distinctive, I suspect, as I'll explain in a moment, about the top universities. That success was inversely correlated with GPA on graduation. That the people, at the top of their class wound up like me, as a computer science professor, going around complaining about the world all the time, right? And the people at the bottom of the class were, Steve Ballmer, or maybe he's not a good example, but these were, because he's going to be the titan of industry, but these were the people who succeeded. I think of Steve because Steve was a very extracurricularly involved guy when he was a high school student and a thing. I don't want to suggest that I've got a view about Microsoft's ethics or anything like that, or his personally, but that the that the people who'd been athletes and had been heavily involved in extracurriculars and whose grades hadn't done that well actually did better in life and were happier with their life in the long run. And you know, the reason was that in a competitive admissions process where everybody who gets in is from the top 5% of the American population or something, the people at the bottom of the top 5% are there because of other qualities that they had, whereas the people at the top of the top 5% are principally there because they did all the things that you describe people as doing, which actually in the long run neither makes them a lot of money nor makes them very happy. So that was the thesis. Okay, so that was somewhat of a flip answer. But you do hit on another thing of which I have some fairly strong feelings. I actually devote two chapters in the book to the grading problem, because it seems to me that the grade inflation issue is noxious because of the way that it increases the competitive emphasis on getting grades as the true metric of achievement in college, and particularly in the absence of any other incentive and reward system for developing any of these other values, except insofar as they can be measured by your getting an A- rather than a B+ in your ethics course. Students will make decisions that are designed to optimize their grade point average, because after all, that's the one thing, you know, at the end of senior year where, you know, they print the list and they show who was first and who was second, or at least who graduated summa and who graduated magna and so on. So people optimize that. And that's profoundly anti-educational, because it means any elective available to the student, if you have an elective slot in your program and your principal objective is to optimize your GPA, you choose the course from which you'll learn the least and know the most, right? That's, you know, in the absence of any other reason to learn. Now, we hope that students will have, you know, some inner ambition and curiosity that will drive them to push against that impulse. But insofar as we overvalue the GPA, we've created a system, as to go back to the phrase that I started, you know, which can best be optimized by learning the least. And you know, there's something profoundly wrong with that. And one of the things you can do against that is to talk a lot about, and you know, in some serious way and in an advising context, and I don't know what all else, you know, somehow get students to recognize that there are other things they should be trying to do with their education other than learning physics, and you know, if they're a physics major, and optimizing their GPA. There has to be some other sole thing out there that the institution teaches is as important. But it's very hard to, you know, I don't see that conversation happening.
And I'm going to come around with the microphone. This one's on, so I'm going to ask you to, if you would, tell a story that is in your book that struck me, Harry, and is related to your point. If you could pass it up to this gentleman here, that would be great. Thank you. In law school, I learned that you don't want to make law from hard cases.
Right.
But, very briefly, the story that really struck me was the one where the young man apparently had cheated when he was asked to redo a test. And the professor had the foresight to copy the test before he handed it. Does that ring the bell?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It really happened.
Yeah, yeah, really quickly. And because it points out also how parents have become over-involved in some ways, and I don't want to take time away from the next question.
This professor had been stung by, you know, people taking their blue books home after they'd been graded and coming back and saying, "You missed my answer, it was there," and, you know, so he'd taken the precaution of photocopying every blue book. Maybe everybody does it now, I don't know. But he, you know, he'd done it, and sure enough, he gives the exam, and this kid, you know, student comes in with his blue book and says, "You missed my answer." And the professor says, "Ah, but I, you know, I have the photocopy, and that answer wasn't there before." And this happened not in a direct conversation, but over a period of days during as the process unfolded. And the kid came back with testimony from his father, who was an engineer. This was a physics problem set that he had dropped the kid at his high school, at some place over spring break, and waited in the car for him and noticed the kid's blue book and saw the test and you know, saw that the kid had the wrong answer and had worked out the math on the right answer and written it in the blue book, and it was the father's scribbles in the kid's corrected blue book, and that, you know, he shouldn't be thrown out for cheating because it was the father's fault, not the son's, for turning in the false answer. So I say, okay, you know, with that kind of parental support for moral education, this is our job.
The question, I'm David Williamson, I'm part of the School of Operations Research here and also involved in the Information Science program. And one of the people who know you primarily, first and foremost, for Lewis and Papademetrio, only your book afterwards.
Yeah.
The question I have is not about the current state of the university or the past, but maybe about its future. I'm just curious in your thoughts about what's the future of the modern research university. And I guess one thought that prompts the question is the sort of the rising costs associated with research universities. And there's some saying by someone that things that can't go on forever eventually
right.
stop. What's the future of a research university?
Yeah, that's a very troubling question. That's a very troubling question because and as a society, we ought to be a lot more worried about that than these questions that I'm raising about what research universities, you know, what universities and colleges should be doing, because the gentleman's point, you know, about the importance of the discoveries that get made in universities to the future of society, our economic future, you know, is very real. You know, I have some hope, and certainly, you know, current administration may give us some reason to hope that there's a social and political recognition of the importance of that role that universities play, right? Research funding is up, not down. But, you know, I also, you know, yesterday morning when I got up to read, I read these stories of Brandeis closing down whole programs and departments. You know, very hard thing to do. You know, they tried to close down their art museum. You know, they didn't do it very well, but, you know, there's no perfect way to do everything. So, I don't have an answer for you. I think you're right. The current, as a national model for higher education, the current economic model does not appear to me to be sustainable.
What are its main threats here? So that we can help with more on the problem, because we're thinking how we can work on it. How would you name them?
Well, I think we're just talking about the cost structure and who's paying the bills. I mean, the bills are ultimately, at this point, being paid by the taxpayers, families who can afford it, and in places like ours, at least, you know, alumni. But there's only. You can't keep shifting the burden onto parents. I mean, you know, I don't know what the financial aid structure is at Cornell, but, you know, Harvard, we've been fortunate, although we've made lots of other sacrifices over the last year, be able to keep the financial aid program involved. But that's not a model that can work for the country, because there just isn't enough money coming out of, for that to be possible. It's a good question. All right. Sorry, I don't have a better answer.
As well. Okay, so why don't we have your question, and we'll probably be right up to our time of 11. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Pedro Perez. I teach undergraduate business management. And maybe I should tell you a little bit about my education so that I frame the question. I'm a chemical engineer, master's in industrial, MBA. I have a master's in Western philosophy and a doctorate in business. From a point of view, this is a liberal arts education. What I find out, and what is really troubling me, is that more and more it is impossible to talk from a common frame to my students. In other words, it is relatively easy to talk to my students in terms of their goals, in terms of what they have to do to achieve their goals, and in terms of the common knowledge that we are trying to achieve. But it is almost impossible to find common references, say, using a Shakespeare quote to illustrate the point, or make a value judgment, literally a value judgment on, for example, pricing strategies. What does this mean for society? The students simply don't get it anymore.
Try sports metaphors.
I have tried. It's not easy either.
At least in America, they usually work. You're absolutely right. As I said in answer to one of the questions I have here, there's a part of that that's very good, right? There's a part of that that's very good because, you know, some of the common frame that we used to be able to assume came because, you know, as a beneficial byproduct of the fact that we had a narrow selection process from American society, right? You know, you were able to assume that people knew the same things because they were all the same to some degree. I mean, this is an exaggeration. So it increases the institutional burden. That's why I keep coming in. It increases the institutional burden to help provide that common frame, but the system has been optimized for specialization, not for giving that common frame to undergraduates. That's a fair description of the problem, and thank you for putting it that way.
Thank you very much. Well, we have a question from our internet audience, and Matt, we'll end with you.
This question comes from the Teaching, Learning, and Technology Department at Stony Brook University, and it refers back to when you were outlining some of the difficulties when looking at evaluations that students are giving. And the questioner wants to know, do you think that one of the fundamental problems is that we don't teach the students to be good evaluators? What about having a student course on what good teaching is and how to provide constructive feedback?
That's a very fair-minded question. I wonder if it came from a student or from a faculty member. But staff, yeah. No, I don't think that's the right solution to the problem. I think this is a psychometric problem. We should talk to people from psychology who do psychometrics all the time, and it's very hard to get a fair assessment out of a student survey like this for reasons that are not going to be solved by teaching students how to be fair evaluators. In any case, that's a waste of their time. That's not an important. If we've got a little more time to teach students something, that isn't something I would spend a lot of time teaching students how to do. I just think that this mode of evaluating faculty is, and as I say, there's plenty of research to support this. Just won't work.
But it is a good question, though. It seems to me it does reflect how much assessment has become part of our thinking that we would
right.
even want to.
Right. Assessment has become part of our thinking, and things that we can provide that will provide reasonable proxies for assessment, even though they actually don't assess anything, have become very important institutional structures. That's absolutely true.
Well, I want to thank again everyone for coming out on a very snowy day, and most especially Professor Lewis for coming
thank
to
you.
Cornell to engage
questions.
Us in these important questions.
I really enjoyed the conversation.
I'll also remind people that at 4:15 in B17 of Upson Hall, Professor Lewis will be speaking on technology and privacy.
Okay, so what was your question that you didn't get?